Well, good morning, TNC family, from my home to wherever you are, amid everything that is going on in our country and world. And let me start with this, Matthew chapter 7, where Jesus is teaching about the link between a human's insides and their outsides, their inward characters and their outward behavior. Verse 16, Jesus says, "Do people pick grapes from a thorn bush or figs from a thistle? No. Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit." What goes on inside determines what gets produced outside, Jesus says. Of course, the Apostle Paul says something similar in Romans chapter 8. Those who live according to the sinful nature have their minds set on what that nature desires. But those who live in accordance with the Spirit have their minds set on what the Spirit desires. Chapter 12, he says, "Do not be conformed to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the continual renewal of your mind." Which leads me to this. In the middle of this pandemic and in the middle of renewed and intensified focus on racial injustice and race relationships in our country, we're spending the majority of our waking hours thinking about different things than we would otherwise be thinking about if we were not in the middle of these two realities. We're thinking less about some things and thinking more about others. For example, here are some things you are likely thinking less about. Morning traffic. Afternoon traffic. These used to be a regular part of our thoughts and conversations. Here's something else you're thinking less about. Where to park at the stadium. Directions to the Airbnb. Organizing that 5-on-5 pickup basketball game. Who will win the weekend series? What clothing to wear for the big event? If your house is ready for that party and those guests, you're almost certainly thinking less about those things. But here are some things you're likely thinking more about. Face coverings, hand washing, social distancing, your home office, your own health, your own finances, the economy, police, first responders, racism, oppression, violence, protests, power. And here's something else you are thinking more about. The stories being told us by script writers and television producers. Because cable news networks have record ratings. And Netflix, for example, released its first quarter figures a couple weeks ago, and they were enormous. Netflix now has more than 183 million global customers. They added over 15 million in the last 3 months. Amazon Prime, similar increases, and Twitter, the sending and receiving of tweets, has soared in this era. Which causes me to remind you that tweets tend to be highly dramatic, which when you get overly dramatic, you tend to get less accurate. And the folks we most follow on Twitter tend to be a small segment of our culture. Actually, only 22% of Americans are even on Twitter. And the problem is, here's the problem, we end up thinking about a sentence instead of a story, a sound bite instead of a larger situation, a headline instead of a history. And as rapper and activist Killer Mike put it last week, talking to local Atlanta residents and to a nation, these mediums are delivering to us fear and anger. Because the truth is, there are no easy answers. There wasn't after 9/11, there is not for COVID-19, and there is not for racial injustice. Instead, it requires listening and learning and thinking and rethinking and stepping out and stepping up and humility and retrying and reevaluating. There are no easy answers, except unfortunately on Twitter. And so let's think together for a few minutes. Because over the last 4 months, we have been thinking about different things and in different ways. And what you think does affect you, your ideas, your beliefs, your behaviors. And it's not just that Jesus said that that's the way it works. We know this from modern science. As we've delved into the human brain, you know, your brain has 86 billion neurons connected to support cells, which also number in the billions, connected to networks that crisscross your brain, communicating with each other with electrical exchanges, somehow coming together to be you. The way you laugh and weep and get hungry and fall in love, or remember that vacation, or what your mom or dad taught you as a kid, all stored in your mind. I've shared more than once before the work of Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi in his book Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience, where he talks about how your mind develops habits of what flows. Your brain takes notes when you do something, when you watch that show, when you think that thought, when you read that tweet, when you consider that idea. Your brain takes notes so that on the off chance you do it again, it'll help you out by bringing it back to mind and helping you do it again, this time with less effort and less energy. Charles Duhigg talks a lot about this in his phenomenal book, by the way, The Power of Habit. And so, for example, if someone says to you, you look great, and you've developed the thought patterns of an optimist, I look great. Whoa, what a friendly guy. Or the pessimist, I look great. Lighting must be bad in here. Or the narcissist, I look great. I was just thinking the same thing. Or the cynic, I look great, eh? Yo, what do you want from me? See, it turns out that your words, actions, habits, and character are shaped by that stream of thoughts and feelings going on inside you all the time. Which, of course, is an observation Jesus made 2,000 years ago. And so if you wonder today why there is racism and sexism, or if you wonder why there is abuse of power and greed, or if you wonder why there's a lack of humility in somebody, just know that it starts with their mind. And if you wonder why there's goodness, or if you wonder why there is servanthood, and if you wonder why there is peace or gentleness, just know that that starts in the mind too. And so in this era, when we're thinking about different things than usual, less about some things and more about others, I want to remind you today that your mind is more important than ever, because your thoughts will become actions, and your actions, habits, and your habits, your character, and your character, your destiny. And you know, for too long, over the last century at least, Churches in America have tried to heal the wounds of the human race superficially. As the prophet Jeremiah says, declaring peace, peace, when there is no peace, except at a very shallow level. I'm just saying it's so easy to be intensely aware of our immediate problems and pains, but unless we look deeper, unless we shine the light brighter into the thought patterns of power and fear and oppression, we won't ever understand what needs to be done if the world is to be really healed, rather than just sort of patched together for a few more years. So I want to talk to you about your mind. I was actually thinking about what to title this teaching, and no joke, I was exercising, walking in my neighborhood, listening to 60s, 70s, and 80s hits from Pandora. And the 1977 Fleetwood Mac song, "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow," came on, and God, through Steve Perry, inspired today's title, "Don't Stop Thinking." So here we go, some things we must not stop thinking about in this era. And first, in this era, don't stop thinking about what you love. Don't stop thinking about what you love. Let me explain, because this is not "don't stop thinking about donuts, Dr. Pepper, and Disney World." This is "don't stop thinking about that thing inside of you that God placed there, that when you think about it, your heart skips a beat and your mind starts dreaming, and you could do it all day long without pay." Because we're in an era of easy distraction. And I've talked to many folks who are just sort of treading water with little sense of purpose and joy. Or they're getting tossed back and forth, getting worried about the pandemic or political positions or the protest or personal pet peeves, things they should be aware of, but not immobilized by. And what's happening is they're losing their curiosity and inner energy and identity and their connection with their divine uniqueness. I'm reading right now a book called The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt by Edmund Morris, the book that won the Pulitzer Prize in 1980. Some of you know, Roosevelt was the first U.S. president to ever ride in a submarine, to own a car, to have a telephone in his own home, to win the Nobel Peace Prize, and the Medal of Honor. He was an author, a member of the science nerd herd, rancher, conservationist, legislator, politician, soldier, governor, adventurer, and the youngest American, youngest president in American history. But it's not like his life was always easy. For example, when he was 26 years old, his wife and his mother died on the same day in the same home, different illnesses. He would write in his journal that day just one sentence, quote, "The light has gone out of my life." And it led to an era of introspection and reevaluation about his life and his passions and his loves. And shortly thereafter, Roosevelt volunteered to go to Cuba and fight in the Spanish-American War. He formed a group, you'll remember, called the Rough Riders, a group of ranchers and Native Americans and some old Ivy League athletes from Harvard, and they sailed to Cuba, and he led them into the Battle of San Juan Hill. But there was a problem. They were at the bottom of the hill, and bullets from Mauser machine guns were coming down at them from the top of San Juan Hill, and his unit was taking heavy losses. And at one point, they came to a barbed wire fence. a fence that they would need to cross in order to try to take the hill, but also a fence that once they crossed it was sort of like, there's no turning back now. And so you see in the book, he has this moment of decision. Turn back, return to safety, or stand up and move forward and fight for San Juan Hill. And the chapter is actually called, listen to this, The Wolf in My Heart. Now think about that word picture. Because he would later write about that day, quote, at that moment, a wolf rose in my heart. A witness, in fact, said later that from that instant, from the instant he stepped across the wire, he, quote, became the most magnificent soldier I have ever seen. Because shells were exploding around him, even burning his skin, yet he pressed on. Because a stray bullet nicked his elbow, but he pressed on. Because there was insane noise and confusion and death, but he pressed on. Because he didn't stop until the battle was won. And for the rest of his life, Roosevelt would actually refer to that day, July 1, 1898, as the greatest day of his life. In New Community, what I'm saying is, I get that we're not taking San Juan Hill every day, but there are things that God has placed in your heart and mind, some skills, some passions, some gifts, some perspectives that are at risk of being lost in this era if we don't continue to think about them and move on them. We can't just watch Netflix in the news and worry about our next paycheck. And so I want to say first, don't stop thinking about what you love. A couple weeks ago, I listened to an interview that Howard Stern did with Jerry Seinfeld. It was a great interview, went viral, and Stern at one point was talking about how it was kind of crazy how they both became famous. Stern said, I never dreamed when I was a nobody that I'd be here. My goal wasn't to get this rich. I just said to myself, I'm going to work at this thing because I just wanted to make a living in radio. And so I spent 10 hours a day at that first radio station, doing everything I could, and it took me years. And I thought, it is possible to will yourself, maybe not to the greatest in the world, but to certainly get where you want. And Seinfeld's response was like, baloney, Howard. Quote, this is what Seinfeld said, I'm gonna adjust your perspective a little bit here, Howard. That was not will. What you were using is not will, it's love. Because when you love something, it's a bottomless pool of energy. That's where it comes from. But you have to love it, Seinfeld said, sincerely. Not because you'll make money or be famous or get what you want to get, but only because you love it. When you love it, you'll get good at it. Stern responds, perhaps you're right, Seinfeld. Of course I'm right, Stern. Thank you, Professor of Humanity. Seinfeld, real love is what enables you to accomplish anything. If you love it, everything else comes behind it. They are the troops behind love. Is the general. And I'm just saying, don't wait for the virus to pass or for the bullets to stop flying from San Juan Hill to think about and pursue what you love. Your music, your painting, your writing, your gardening, your reading, your friendships, education, your sense of humor, your unique empathy, your dreams. Whatever God has put in your heart, I'm saying if you love art, don't give up art to watch more news all the time. Instead, use your art in this era to make a difference. Use whatever you love to advance the things of God. Don't stop thinking about what you love. Number two, here's the second kind of thinking that we need to be especially proactive about engaging in this era. Second, don't stop thinking about who you are loving. Number one was don't stop thinking about what you love. Number two, don't stop thinking about who you're loving. Because you're likely aware that over the first 5 months of 2020, volunteering, thinking about others, volunteering at local charities is way down. And also, charitable giving is way down. And of course, when you can't meet face-to-face to share a few kind, thoughtful words with a friend, and when you aren't at work with colleagues to get them that cup of coffee or to go out to lunch with them, it does make thinking about others harder. But in this era, we cannot fall into the trap of an isolated life and an individualized faith. We can't stop thinking about others and serving others and giving to others. We cannot allow our faith to become introverted in this era. I reread recently Eugene Peterson's book, Reversed Thunder, St. John and the Praying Imagination. And he has a great chapter on how we must not move into an individualized faith. Listen to what he writes. He says, "The gospel is never for individuals, but always for a people. Sin fragments us, separates us, and sentences us to solitary confinement. The gospel restores us, unites us, and sets us in community. The life of faith, revealed and nurtured in the biblical narratives, is highly personal, but never individual. Always there is a family, a tribe, a nation, a church. God's love and salvation are revealed and experienced in the congregation of the people, not alone." He writes, "The gospel always pulls us together. One of the immediate changes that the gospel makes," he says, "is grammatical. We instead of I, our instead of my, us instead of me." He goes on, "Sin, both our own and that of others, drives us into selfishness. Separation from God becomes separation from neighbor. The same salvation that restores our relations with God reinstates us into a community of persons who live by faith. Every tendency to privatism and individualism distorts and falsifies the gospel." Now, in my reading about Teddy Roosevelt, let me tell you, he was far from perfect. Far. But he did have a social conscience, and he did think about others, and he did care about others, all Americans, including he valued greatly the idea of extending the American ideal to every person, no matter their creed or birthplace. In fact, in October of 1901, Roosevelt invited Booker T. Washington to dine at the White House with him. And in doing so, he was the first president to entertain an African American in the White House. And it provoked white outrage. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution wrote in the days after, quote, "There's a feeling of indignation among Southern men that the president would take this opportunity to show a marked courtesy and distinction to a Negro." And the Memphis, Tennessee newspaper wrote, quote, President Roosevelt has committed a blunder that is worse than a crime. And no atonement or future act of his can remove this self-imprinted stigma. And an Alabama newspaper wrote, "He might now just as well sleep with Booker Washington, for the scent of that," and then a word I won't say, "will follow Roosevelt to the grave." And the events of the past months and weeks in our country have let us know that racism is not only an 18th, 19th, or 20th century problem in our country. The last few days in our country have highlighted that we still have a long ways to go to figure out how to love others well. Which is why last Sunday and last Thursday night, in person, outside at the church, and then in a WebEx online forum, we all met to listen and learn together how we can continue to think about how we're loving others. And my question for you here is, how are you loving others? How are you loving others with your voice? How are you loving with your time? How are you loving with your money? How are you loving those outside your immediate color, DNA, neighborhood, and comfort zone? By the way, Jesus was really clear. It is not of great credit to you if you love those who are like you and who love you back. The greatest credit is, how do you love those different from you? Friends, in this era, we cannot stop thinking about who we're loving. First, what you love, what God put inside of you. Secondly, who you're loving. And then number three, the third kind of thinking that we need to be especially proactive about engaging in this era. Third, don't stop thinking about what you're learning, what you're learning. I'm talking about refusing to assume that you have everything figured out. In other words, think about everything you've said or posted in the past 10 days and then assume you got some of it wrong. I'm talking about an attitude of humility and growth, about refusing to stop rethinking things. Because life is filled with new discoveries and new learnings across all fields. For example, if I had told you 10 years ago, hey, listen, in the near future, you're going to get into a stranger's car and they're going to take you places. You'd have been like, no, there's no chance. Oh, and then sometimes strangers will go to restaurants and grab your food and bring it to your home. Who, friends will? No, strangers. Oh, you mean staff at the restaurant. No, I mean literal Uber Eats strangers. David, no chance. No chance I'm gonna ever do that. And if I had told you 10 years ago that in 2020, 75% of people would say they prefer watching movies at home to going to the theater, you'd say, not likely. But new information is always coming into our world. And it's not just with movies and cars. It's with science and history and archaeology and cosmology. And the challenge is always, am I willing to change the way I think about something? About the way I have always thought about something? And I get it's not easy because the familiar and the habitual and the routine are so reassuring. But I would just add, falsely reassuring. This actually has a scientific label in sociology. It's called the sunk cost fallacy, the sunk cost fallacy. Let me explain. Have you ever been like reading a book or watching a movie or a TV series and thought, this is horrible, no good at all, I should just turn this off? But then you think, actually, I'm not throwing in the towel, I've already watched the first 4 episodes. I'll at least finish the first season. Or with a movie, I'm not throwing away the $9 I spent to stream this thing. And yet the money is already gone, sunk. You've spent the money no matter if you finish watching it or not. It's already a sunk cost. And this happens with investors and their stocks. This happened in America during the Vietnam War. We extended our involvement because the thinking was, well, we've already sacrificed this much for the war. It'd be a mistake to give up now. Now let me get more personal. Maybe you have a friend who struggled for a long time in a bad relationship. Her boyfriend has cheated on her more than once. And each time, he came back truly sad and sorry. And so your friend tells you, I've just invested so much energy in the relationship, it would be wrong to throw it away now. Sunk cost fallacy. Or maybe you've thought one way politically, or about the environment, or about racism for a long time. And so feel like you have to stick with what you're thinking. Sunk cost fallacy. Or in the theological realm. Well, I've always read the King James Version. And I don't care if it was written before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and other earlier, more reliable texts. I'm sticking with it. I've always believed the earth is flat. I'm not buying this round earth orbiting the sun conspiracy. I've always believed that hell is a real place burning forever and ever, so I'm not going to consider any new, better biblical scholarship on this topic. I'm saying if you recognize any of these thinking patterns, it shows that the sunk cost fallacy is at work in your brain. Jesus put it like this: new wine must be put in new wineskins. Implication, there will be new wine. You should expect that you will see things differently today than you did 5 years ago. And by the way, if you can't figure out in your mind how you're thinking about things differently, how you were wrong before, if you can't think of any area, then big alarm bells should be ringing in your mind. I mean, what are you engaging in? Praying, thinking, journaling, reading, small group discussions. How are you intentionally growing in your understanding of issues that matter, of the divine? Or are you content to just think the same things you've always thought, because it feels so safe and familiar? And can I challenge you with the words of Barbara Brown Taylor in her book, Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith? She writes, quote, I have learned to prize holy ignorance more highly than religious certainty, and to seek companions who have arrived at the same place. Friends, in this era, do not settle for Instagram posts about God and Facebook fallacies about history and Twitter sentences about social justice. Don't settle. Go deeper. Don't stop thinking about what you're learning. Don't stop thinking about what you love. Don't stop thinking about who you're loving. And don't stop thinking about what you're learning. And finally, don't stop thinking about eternity. In an era, you know, where we're considering the present the present with such intensity. And our finances and our health and our entertainment and our job numbers and new cases of the virus and human rights, civil rights, politics, all these are important things. But in an era when we're considering the present with such intensity, we must also continue to contemplate the transcendent and the eternal. Because there's a real danger in getting caught up in the next news flash, the next episode, the next step, the next meal, the next. Because your mind can just get overwhelmed and cluttered and pulled to the left and the right by so many. And the noise can just be deafening. I actually think this is part of what Killer Mike was talking about in his emotional speech in Atlanta. I think this is what Jesus was saying when he said, look, you've got to stop the intense barrage of constant noise in your mind and in your soul. And consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And the idea is, your mind and mine need space and need that quiet walk and need that moment of prayer and that time of silence and that contemplation of the transcendent and the divine. There's an ancient parable about a young prince who was sent to a wise teacher to study how to become a good ruler. And the first assignment that the prince's teacher gave him was to spend 3 months in the forest alone. And so the prince did that. And when he returned, the teacher asked him to describe what he had heard. And the prince said, I could hear birds singing and leaves rustling and hummingbirds hum, crickets chirp, owls hoot, bees buzz, and the wind whisper and holler. So the teacher said, now return to the forest to listen for what more you have missed. So the prince went back, sat alone in the forest for several more days and nights, wondering what the teacher could be talking about. But then one morning, he started to hear faint sounds that he had never heard before. And upon his return, the prince told the master, when I listened more closely, I could hear the unheard, the sound of flowers opening, the sound of the sun warming the earth, the sound of the grass drinking the morning dew. And then the teacher nodded and said, to hear the unheard, this is what is important, to hear the eternal things, the deep things, the things that matter most of all. A new community in this era, we must steer our minds toward the transcendent and the timeless, as well as the immediate. We need to hear what's being said beneath the tweets and the posts and the protests. We need to consider what it means that we are all created by the divine and for the divine and are infused by the divine and have this divine, guaranteed, eternal future. And we need to help one another think about these things. So today I remind you, I urge you, don't stop thinking about what you love and who you're loving and what you're learning and the things of eternity. Will you pray with me now? Oh God, renew our minds. Renew our minds. Renew our minds today and in the days ahead with your wisdom and your care and your love. Amen.